Good evening. So last week we were speaking of the difference between form and formless awareness. And I just wanted to read this piece from Suzuki Roshi on, I think, this point. He's got a section in his book, Not Always So, called Resuming Big Mind. A big mind seems to be a name for this formless awareness. Suzuki Roshi says, most of the time in our everyday life, we're involved in the activity of small mind. That's why we should practice Zazen and be completely involved in resuming big mind. In our practice, we rely on something great and sit in that great space. As long as you do not lose the feeling, the pain you have in your legs or some other difficulty is happening in that great space. As long as you do not lose the feeling that you are in the realm of Buddha nature, you can sit even though you have some difficulty. When you want to escape from your difficulty or when you try to improve your practice, you create another problem for yourself. But if you just exist there, then you have a chance to appreciate your surroundings and can accept yourself completely without changing anything. That's our practice. To exist in big mind is an act of faith, he says, which is different from the usual faith of believing in a particular idea or being. It is to believe that something is supporting us and supporting all our activities, including thinking mind and emotional feelings. All these things are supported by something big that has no form or color. It's impossible to know what it is, but something exists there, something that's neither material nor spiritual. Something like that always exists, and we exist in that space. That's the feeling of pure being. So that, I think, sounds to me like this formless awareness, this big space that all our experiences are happening within, and this big mind is supporting us always. And I thought it's interesting that he says we access it through this faith, or maybe we could say trust. And then there's, I think, a fine line between a kind of a blind faith, just because we hear about it and it sounds good, that kind of faith, versus having some sense experiential trust that we are in this space through investigating our own experience. So, shall we continue where we left off, which was we had a long discussion, and I think conversation is good in this realm to keep clarifying. Let's pick up on, this is still in chapter 2, page 31, this section on time, distance, and separation. It's on page 2 of this handout, or page 31 of the book. Yeah? Do you have this section?
Why
don't you read that section of that paragraph 31 on time, distance, and separation.
Within the paradigm created by thought, words isolate each object from another and create an imposed distance between objects. The distance between objects is perceived as real, and when distance is established, time is needed to travel that distance. Once consciousness becomes identified with a thought, the sense of self becomes dependent upon the time and distance to navigate through the world. When I want something, I must first isolate the wanted object from other forms and accomplish that by thinking about the object. Now I must travel the distance to procure the object, and that journey takes time. Time and distance came from the worldview created within the thought and are fixed notions that logically follow the abstract reasoning of thought.
So I think this is getting, I think, kind of difficult now, right? But I think the gist of what's being said here is that we've been talking a lot about how conceptual thought is basically like constructing our version of the world, and all our kind of problems and difficulties are kind of conceptually constructed ideas, and in the stillness of presence, as we know in Zazen, everything is simpler and easier. And so here it's questioning what I think of as like the most basic conceptual thoughts called time and space, which we usually don't think of as conceptual thoughts. These seem like the inherent reality, time and space. And then into this realm of time and space we are born, and then we can start constructing thoughts. But in this consensus paradigm he's proposing, and I think most spiritual traditions in their deepest layers also agree that what we call time and space really are dependent on our conceptual mind. And his way of talking about it, he says we set up two different things, and then we set up distance between them, and then we set up the time that it takes to arrive at them. I would say, to try to approach this more experientially, maybe interesting to look at the distance between what seems like the awareness and then the objects of awareness. It seems like there's distance between them. Like you hear the sound of my voice, and it might seem like you, the awareness, are like 10 feet from my voice, or 15 feet, depending where you're sitting in the room. But that sense of distance is based on you as an ear, and me and the sound coming from my mouth. But experientially, as awareness, if we really just be the formless awareness, the experiencing of sound, and then we ask, how far away is the sound from me, the experiencing, the knowing, the awareness, then we can't find any distance. We can't say it's really close or it's really far. It's just, it's almost as if sound fills the awareness. Like awareness is like this big space, like Suzuki Roshi says, there's this big space that everything is happening in. And we could call it's an alive, knowing space. And in this space, it maybe helps to warm up to it with our eyes closed. And when we're listening to sound with our eyes closed, you can maybe have the sense, not so difficult to have the sense, that sound is filling this whole black space. That we are this black space of awareness with our eyes closed. We're focusing on the sound sense by minimizing a visual sense by closing our eyes. So now, can you have that feeling of like sound is filling the space of awareness? Putting aside our ideas about, I think it's coming from the southern direction where Kokyo is sitting or something. So those are good ideas, but they're kind of based on conceptual thinking. In our experience, to me, it feels like sound is filling the space, and it has no distance from the aware space that it's filling because it fills that space. Do you have some sense of that?
Black space. Mm-hmm. Then the color disappeared too.
When we close our eyes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And at first it was like, oh yeah, that's a black space.
Oh.
But then
I see what you mean. Yeah. That's true. I mean, black is how can you name it, right? That's true. It's relative to other colors. In some ways, when our eyes are open, all the colors we distinguish because they're relative to other colors, different frequencies, wavelengths of color. And but in the eyes closed space, what color is that when your eyes are closed, right? Yeah. So sound seems to not necessarily have any distance, and likewise we can try out the same exercise a little bit harder maybe, but it's the exact same principle by looking at things. We're looking at the distant wall, and we can say how far away from the eye is it? Well, it's 15 feet, 20 feet from the eye, but from the knowing awareness that is, that includes everything. How far away is the distant wall? It's really like no distance, right? Experientially. So the 20 feet thing is a conceptual idea that's very deeply conditioned to think this way. And we can pull out a tape measure and we can measure it. But meanwhile, as we're walking across the room to measure it, are we really going anywhere? From the point of view of awareness, do we ever actually go anywhere? Can you have some sense of this? Does anyone not follow this? It's like awareness is like this just aware, empty, knowing space. And we could say that from its point of view, it never moves anywhere. Right? It's as if the world is moving through it. Right? If you are the awareness, and then... is it like you pick up your awareness, like it's located in your head or something, and you walk around the world carrying this awareness? Granted, I think that is the way we usually think. But just by being the awareness, if we actually try to almost identify ourselves with the awareness, do I, the awareness, actually move? Or is it that the experiences are moving through me? I am the big space of awareness, right? In which all experiences are happening. Can we, again, it's a shift of perspective, like these optical illusions. Can we try on this perspective where I am the big aware space, and if I'm moving my hand like this, it's not that or maybe it's more like if I'm going like this, like we can say the hand is still. And we usually say, I'm bringing my awareness closer to the hand. But can we do the same exercise where it's like, I, the awareness, I'm not moving at all. But the sense of the body moving, that's physical sensations, and the visual image of the hand, they are what's actually moving those experiences, called even the body bending, and the hand seem to be getting closer. That those are experiences happening in this unmoving, unchanging space. These are the qualities that were mentioned earlier. It's ever present, it doesn't change. Yes?
It seems so hard because it's like, okay, if the awareness isn't moving, and it's like not really here, then where is it? Then it's like tempting to say like, oh, it's in some other realm, maybe, for example.
Well, or we can just say, most experientially, we can say, we cannot find a location for it. If we found a location for it, that location would be like an experience or an object of awareness. So even if we see, it's actually, I think it's located in the head or the body or emanating from the body. But again, from this new perspective, from this paradigm shift, let's say the knowing awareness, the experiencing itself, doesn't have any location.
It's also brings up a sense of dis-ease a little bit for me, because it makes me feel like everything that I've ever found comfortable or comforting or helpful or like or whatever is suddenly like not really as it seems, or it's like kind of
not as it seems. You could say, I agree, it's not as it seems, but yet it's not that it's nothing's there either, right? Because we could say, if the big space of awareness is, if that's who we truly are, big meaning not a certain size, but unlimited, boundless awareness, formless. Formless awareness means it has no form, therefore no location. Has no, even as Suzuki Roshi said, it's not material or spiritual, meaning like it's not some other realm of being either. And yet, everything happens normally. Like, right, here we are, there's Arye over there and Koki over here, we're having a conversation. So it's not like that changes in the slightest, but the perspective on it changes. Now it's like, you have no distance from me anymore. Me, remember, me here is not Koki and not the I, but me is the boundless, formless awareness. You have no separation or distance from me. So therefore, even just a little bit, opening to that new paradigm, there's a kind of intimacy. There's a kind of like, it feels like you're over there, but in fact, you're right here. You're no distance. And it's not like you're suddenly like, where you're in my face or something, because, the face is still over here and the face is over there, but the knowing that's holding our faces is one knowing awareness. Yes?
Describe like that, it's useless. You can't do anything with it, and so it's hard to want to take on that
perception.
Or
new perspective. Yeah, you could say, we might say, what's the use of this perspective? It actually maybe makes it harder to navigate the world, because I might, like, if I really feel like I am just the space in which there's a body walking, I might actually, like, start wobbling as I'm walking or something, right? Because I'm so used to thinking of me, the body and mind walking. So at first it might even seem more inefficient. And what's the point of it? And of course, as we know from that this teaching is exploring this, it's not really about usefulness, but by shifting this perspective, we can say, it puts everything in a new perspective. It puts our problems in a new perspective.
I think it's helpful. But I was just trying to, like, locate within myself what would be the resistance.
That's right. That's right. The resistance is like, why should I do this?
So.
Yeah, I think that's true. It looks like we're losing self-power. And in a way, that's true. Yeah. And we could say that losing self-power is part of the joy of this awakening. Self-power meaning like individual separate self-power. So I think it is good to keep making the connections, which I think this book is pretty good at doing, keeps tying it back to the Buddha's basic teaching of suffering and the end of suffering. He's really coming from he's a Theravada Buddhist teacher, so he keeps trying to, it brings up various different paradigm shifts, but the suffering and end of suffering is like the basic one. And, so we can keep exploring how this big mind perspective, actually, we have a different relationship to our problems. They're more like, as he says, your leg pain is happening in this big space. I think this was a Sesshin talk of Suzuki Roshi. Then it's a little bit, the leg pain is there, but it's now, it's being held by this big space, and in a way it is the big space. So yes. Well, we're into distance here, right? And time, he says, like the time to reach an object. You know, if I was writing that paragraph on time, space, and separation, which it's called, I might approach it a little differently. Maybe this is another way to talk about it, is that we've been talking about different names for that he's calling formless awareness, or the formless paradigm. Formless awareness. Suzuki Roshi is calling it big mind, which is like a big space. And like vast space where nothing is lacking and nothing is extra. And another name for it, in terms of distance, we could call it here. I would propose a name for this formless awareness. We can call it here. But not here as a particular point in time, in space, not here as opposed to over there, but the all-inclusive here. This space is always here, and it includes all locations. All from the point, remember, this is from the point of view of awareness. It is always here, right? And everything, everything in it is here, actually. From the point of view of awareness, there is no there. Can you get a sense of this? Try to, in your own experience. Everything is here, meaning like, there's no distance. That's another way of talking about no distance. And to finish the story about time, we could, another name for this big space besides formless awareness and here, another name for it, I would propose, is now. And again, not the now that's like a point, a moving point in a stream of time, which is, this is how usually I think we often might think of now as like, now is just, and it just passed, and then we're like moving along this, you know, this flow, and we're always now with the past is trailing behind us and the future is coming towards us. This now is like the now that has always been. It's not a point between the past and the future, but it's, again, the all-inclusive now. Like the all-inclusive here includes what we call over there. The all-inclusive now includes what we call past and future. And it never, and again, it never changes. This now is not like something moving along. It's the now, like the eternal now, we could say. And again, this is not like a, I hope, an abstract idea, but to actually try on this perspective that we have always been, from the, as awareness, we have always been here and now. It's impossible for awareness to be any other place than here and now. So that's another way of talking about how, the awareness is the here and now, and then the sense of space, or like over there, is really just part of what we call here, and the sense of time as like yesterday or tomorrow is actually really always here, always now. Yes.
I'm reminded of the first book that I got me into spirituality. Ram Dass.
Yeah.
See, here, now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually, I think, a really profound title, almost like a cliche. You know. And we say that was, you know, the beginning of this type of spirituality in the West, and we might say that was kind of naive. Just say, be here now. But in fact, when I consider that, I think it's incredibly profound, and very, very simple to be sure, but actually, be here now, and that's actually what is already the case. We could say be here now means like align ourselves with reality that is always here and now, and is always being here and now.
Now be here.
Now be here.
Or now here be.
Now here be. Yeah. Seeing is happening in the be here now. So can you follow this? As a not an abstract idea, but do you have a sense that when we talk about this formless awareness, as much as possible, it's nice to like, actually, let's try it on and check it out from this perspective. We might say, how can I just be the formless awareness? Well, maybe it's not that big a deal. It can just be like, actually, I am the formless awareness. It's what's ever present. It's what's present right now. And it includes the world of form, but the world of form and appearances and distance and time and all of the conceptual constructions are kind of happening in this space, the boundless space of awareness, which is called here, all-inclusive here, and now, the all-inclusive now. And one last point about the here and now I would add in is that all the conceptually constructed other places, all the theirs, like we could say, the wall over there, that's not right here. But in fact, as awareness, it is right here. Right? So in a way, you could say all the theirs are, their true nature is actually here. Or all the theirs are actually made out of here-ness. And all the other times, from the perspective of now, we are now, are just our memory of yesterday is, even that, is like, is right now, right? So it might seem like all the other times are their true nature is now. The true nature of yesterday and tomorrow is always now. You could see, even say yesterday and tomorrow are made out of now.
Huh? T.S. Eliot's Burton Orchard.
Yeah. Do you remember how that line goes? Yeah, I can't remember either, but yeah, exactly. There's a beautiful poetic description of, I think it is the same point of the now all being contained right here and now.
When you were reading from Suzuki Roshi right away, he talks about faith.
Yes.
And belief.
Yeah.
And God.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wondered if you know, in places where populations grow up Buddhist,
uh-huh.
Do they just know this? because I don't know anybody who, if anybody has experience going someplace where they try to explain to you as an adult God. This is God. This is how to think about.
Yeah.
Sort of people grow up.
It's true. It'd probably be good if there was more conversation in the Christian world and the Jewish world about like, what do we mean by this? Because I think we often take it for granted. And so I don't know, but I think that in Buddhist countries, it's not like everybody sort of knows big mind from the beginning. I don't think so. I think he's really speaking to Zen practitioners who practice Zazen and therefore can really have a more direct sense of this big mind in their Zazen practice. Because I think outside of Zazen practice, it is harder to talk about. It sounds abstract. But when I was reading that, I also had the sense that this sounds like a kind of theistic, like a Christian, Judeo-Christian kind of God, when he's saying there's this big space that's always supporting us, and we can have faith in that. It sounded very God-like. And I think in modern America and in these non-dual movements, there's many teachers that are very comfortable going back and forth between the language, Adyashanti is one of them, right? Yeah. Between using the word God for this formless awareness and like, you know, our true self or Buddha nature or emptiness. And they almost like interchangeably. And some maybe more orthodox religious people might say, wait a second, don't mix it all up. But I kind of appreciate being able to go there, or some Christians might say, that's not my God, formless awareness. But it's interesting, I think, and if we say that, well, all religions are coming from the same, there can't be more than, if we're talking about reality, as we were last week, in reality, there can't be more than one reality. And so could it be the same thing called by different names, or could it be that actually there are slightly different experiential takes or slightly different conceptualizations of the one inconceivable reality, and the conceptual descriptions tend to distort it and limit it. And that's why we're looking for the most accurate and helpful descriptions. Yes.
For me, what's helpful is to hear it from different languages, because otherwise I get too conceptual.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think Ajna's really trying to use language that's not normally used to get people out of their concepts.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't like to talk about enlightenment, or because people say, oh, that's the Buddha, I can't get
that. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Because he uses all these different words.
Yeah.
But isn't it that the religions, the mystical aspects of these religions, they all do start to sound the same, don't they?
They sound very similar, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and then it's just a matter of translation. Mm-hmm. And maybe using God in Buddhist circles is kind of nice, because it pokes at the Buddhists. What are you saying God for? And then using Buddha nature in Christian settings is good, because it kind of, or enlightenment or something, because it kind of like, how can you say my God is enlightenment? So, anyway, yes.
So, may I ask one other thing?
Mm-hmm.
We were saying two things a moment, like Liz was saying that maybe like engaging deeply with this objectless awareness is kind of useless, and or has a feeling of uselessness, because it's like you can't get anything from it per mm-hmm. se through its understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it was said a moment ago that also like we're abiding in a space that's always supporting us in a way.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that if we're unable to let go of this part that's I still find it kind of unsettling, because it does seem so useless, and you can't get all these normal things through it if you're thinking about it. And so it seems to me that maybe a certain amount of faith is required if you haven't let go of this wanting, that you are continuously supported in spite of leaving this way. I mean, the in spite of isn't quite correct, maybe, if you fully have the faith. If you realize it.
Yeah, I think we can try it out. We try it out in little ways throughout the day, right? Like right now, for example. and see, because one thing is, especially just try to use these examples about time and space. If we really say that, we really know that who we are is this now, this ever-present now, And that might feel disconcerting to the actually who we are is this limited body and mind that's constantly changing and is going to die. If we are we are the now, then the now can never disappear. So we might have a sense of actually there's comfort in being the now, the awareness called the now. And also maybe even more practically, we say we're really worried about something that's going to happen tomorrow. And if we remember that actually I am the eternal now, and everything I will have to face in this life, I will face it now. And so kind of worrying about a different projected conceptual now of tomorrow becomes less of an issue. We're like, I'll be here now. And when so-called tomorrow rolls around, then I will face that now. And it actually, to me, that's relieving, instead of all the worry that goes into the future, and maybe also sort of mourning the past. We might even say from this perspective, say we've lost a loved one in the past, we might say that from this really unusual perspective of being the now, that person who is no longer alive is actually with us now. That might be strange. It's like we can't see them, you know, and talk to them. And we miss that, of course. But in another, deeper way, who they are is also now, and they are so.
And also, like the horrors of the past and the future too are ever present in a way.
They are, but
sometimes.
Well, but yeah. I mean, but this now takes all these different forms, and those past now is are not manifesting in that way now. It's not, again, it's not an abstract thing where now we're suddenly like overrun by billions of years crushing down on us like all at once in this confusion. Of course, it's not like that. It's more like this, where we're just here now, but it's just, we just know that it includes all of that. It includes everybody and everything and all that's ever been and will be. And actually, I think that's, there's relief in that. It's a bigger perspective. It also puts our worries about the future and our regrets about the past, it puts them in a little different perspective. Well, there's just now. And also the space dissolving into here-ness is, I think also it has practical implications of like how am I going to go, like I have to go so far. Maybe I'm traveling and I have to drive 1,000 miles or something. That's such a long distance. But if I think, actually, I'm not going anywhere. The big space doesn't have to and cannot ever go anywhere. It's always here. And the road will unwind before me. Now, here and now. I think getting used to this more, it's actually very comforting. It's very relieving, even though maybe it's disconcerting to the separate individual self, because maybe this loss of individual self power, or like we're so used to identifying myself with the body and mind limited 5 skandhas package, which has all kinds of problems because basically, it's on its way to death and old age and sickness and all kinds of stuff. So it's shifting our identity. I think I mentioned last week is a way to talk about this. We're usually identified with, meaning like thinking, identity means being one with. We usually think we're identified with this body and mind. I am one with this body and mind. That's who I am, is the body and mind are 5 skandhas, which the Buddha says, these 5 skandhas are not myself. And so we can re-identify with the formless awareness, which is not a thing. So it's, Buddha says, don't identify with anything constructed or anything impermanent, and compounded. But this space is not like that. So we could say that is actually who I am. If we shift our identity, which I think we can playfully actually choose to do, just at least try it on. We maybe can't create that permanent shift because our identity is actually created by habits, I would say, identifying with the body and mind as my true self. But we can try on this shift of identity. I'm the space that holds body and mind. Body and mind is part of me. But also your body and mind is part of me too. In fact, your body and mind is equally myself as this body and mind. That's where it gets kind of unusual. Still, you know, I'm going to feed this body, and maybe I feed your body sometimes too, but like we have, the way it works out is we take care of this body in a unique way. But we're really, this is the realm of non-separation. Where the big space is holding all of us, and it doesn't put this body and mind above your body and mind, for example. But our habits are very strong to take care of this one first, and we'll probably continue that way. But it's a new perspective, and this is an incredibly compassionate, loving perspective, isn't it, to see that all the manifestations are equally me. Me here, meaning the formless awareness. So continue. So now there's a little guided meditation. This one's, I think, a little bit hard. See what we think. How about Rita could read this?
34. Take a moment and see if you are able to access this living present. It has to be here and available, or it's just another mental abstraction. Quiet down so that your senses become alive and you are less directed by your thoughts. Awareness discerns the sense of I becoming more vague as a presence becomes acutely sensed. You cannot carry yourself along with the growing sense of presence because presence takes away the past and future, the very way you form yourself. Hear the sounds, smell the odors, and softly see the forms arising in this moment. Resist investing energy in thinking about what is sense, and hold the sensation just as it is, free of thought. Let awareness be expansive so there are no limitations. Now sense what holds all the shapes, sounds and sensations of this moment and feel the living moment itself.
Can I sit with this for a minute? That's it. Maybe particularly notice the awareness discerning the sense of I, here being the small I, the limited body-mind self, becoming more vague as presence or awareness becomes acutely sensed. You cannot carry yourself, your separate self, along in the growing sense of presence. Yeah. Okay. Can you settle into this presence?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. That which holds all the sounds and shapes and sensations.
Physical. That last line was very much like Suzuki.
Yes. Yeah. The last line. Now sense what holds all the shapes, sounds, and sensations of this moment and feel the living moment itself, or the now. Yes?
For me, it was really like, I could really sense that something is supporting me.
Huh.
And it, there was a sense of relaxation and being touched.
Yeah.
Want to do it right and just let, like yesterday you had to
Yeah, it is like that. Mm-hmm. I think that's true, that it's really about a deep relaxation into our sense of being. And in Zen we often emphasize, you know, sitting upright, keeping a good posture, and there's an atmosphere of making great effort and so on. And I think that is one side of all of this, but I think for this type of big mind practice, I think that the key points are like deep relaxation and non-striving and really settling and letting be into the present. And I think sometimes the sense, well, there's a whole chapter or large section coming up, maybe in the later chapters, about effort. And really he's emphasizing the kind of effortlessness. And so it's a balance, because sometimes we don't make any effort, and then the habitual mind of just chatter and running story loops and so on takes over. So that's where we're always playing with effort and non-effort. So one thing I noticed in this exercise we just did is almost like these two potential kinds of meditation. First he said, hear the sounds, smell the odors, and softly see the forms arising in this moment. That's like one practice that we could call like mindfulness of the experiences that are happening. Mindfulness of sound, mindfulness of color and smell, mindfulness of body and breath. You can, all of these things that are the objects of experience, we can just hear them, just see them. And then I hear it as like a second type of meditation at the end there. Now sense what holds all, what it is that holds all these shapes, sounds, and sensations of this moment, and feel the living moment. Can you see how those could be seen as like two different meditations? One, and I think it's nice progression between them is when we first start sitting, I think it's helpful to first actually practice mindfulness of so-called objects like the breath and the physical sensations of the body and the sounds, and like because in a non-conceptual way we're settling into basically paying attention to it, the experience of the present. And we could do that for a whole, I think that many people practice this is the whole meditation, but then we can make this shift that's like we're still paying attention to the present experience, but it's this backward step of now we're also can shift the attention to that which it holds, the experience. We could call the experiencing. So it's a little more subtle, and now we can say it's no longer mindfulness of objects. Now we could say it's mindfulness of awareness, or being aware of being aware. I think it's nice to distinguish between these, and that they can work very nicely together, but to notice that they're actually two slightly different practices. Could you follow that? Mm-hmm. Mindfulness of experiences, that is any object of awareness, which includes physical sensations such as the breath and the body. It can be completely non-conceptual physical experiences, which all the five senses are non-conceptual. Colors, sounds, smells, tastes, physical sensations, these five. Physical sensations includes the movement of the breath. Mindfulness of these objects of experience, and then the that backward step of shifting the attention to the space that's holding all of these experiences. Yes.
I've read about you have the observer, and then you have the observer of the observer, and I always thought that they didn't talk about the observer of the observer of the observer, because at that point you could go on forever. But through the things we've been reading here, it seems like they only get to the observer of the observer, because if it seems like here, if you observe the observer, then realization occurs.
Well, I guess I probably wouldn't use the word observer, because, or like the, say the subject of the object, because observer is like another noun. It's like a, it almost seems like the observer could be like the thinking mind, or the eye, the visual consciousness, or the hearing consciousness might sound like the observer. Whereas I would say, to shift it out of the observer and the observed, I would say that the observer is another subtle kind of object from the point of view of awareness, the all-inclusive awareness, where we know that sights and sounds and sensations are so-called objects. And then we might say, well, the awareness is the subject. But I would say, actually, the subject is the kind of sense of me as a body, particularly a body and a five skandhas package here that's the subject. And remember, this big space includes both the subject and the object, both. So rather than saying observing the observer, I would say more like we're observing the observing, which is not a thing. And when we're observing the observing is observing the observing, then we could say it's not actually two different things. If we split it into two different things, then one of them, I would say, is a subject or an experience of some kind. When we say observing or minding mind or being aware, it's a way of talking, but it's not really two different things. And I would say there's no such thing as a tertiary third one. Because if we do that, then we're making them into some sort of subtle object. You can't, in this perspective of the big mind, you can't go back further. You can't take a backward step behind that. It's because it's all inclusive. There can't be anything outside of it or behind it. It is the experiencing. And no, there can't be another observer of the experiencing.
So then the golden question is, how do you think you're observing that? If you're...
Well, you don't have to think that you're observing.
I mean, okay.
How do you know that you are?
Sure, if this is the background awareness that contains all, then what's separate from it in order to be aware of it or observe it?
Yeah, it's different from every other... It's different from every type of experience, because every experience would have an experiencer, an experience. Every experience, the way I use the word experience, is inherently dualistic. It's happening to somebody, whereas the experiencing is non-dualistic. So there isn't anybody experiencing it. It is self-fulfilling samadhi. Self-enjoyment samadhi. It is enjoying itself and fulfilling itself. It is, there is no other. And we could say, who is it that knows that? There is no other that knows that. It's unusual in this way. This is the language of it's illuminating itself. Awareness is illuminating itself like a candle is illuminating the whole world around it, but it's also illuminating itself at the same time. You don't need another candle to illuminate the first candle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is this the jewel gear of samadhi?
Yes.
It's timeless, and it gets into the spacelessness, and then I can't remember if something...
In its greatness, it is utterly beyond location. Yeah, yeah, I think, and that yeah. This is another name for this big mind, is the jewel mirror, the precious mirror. Samadhi, you could say, is like presence, or awareness even. And it's like a mirror that reflects everything. And that line is a great commentary on this paragraph we just read about time, about actually distance. Because we say, how big is this? Suzuki Roshi calls it big mind because he's emphasizing, compared to small mind, it seems big. So I think big mind is a nice way to put it. But this big mind is not like a size. It's not like really big. It's not like even bigger than big. It's not supersized. It's like that Jewel Mirror Samadhi says, it's so fine, it fits into spaciousness. Like it's small, you know, it's poetically, Dongshan is saying, it's smaller than the tiniest point, and it's so vast, it transcends dimension, or it's beyond all location. I think that's a beautiful expression, because we usually think of the really big, but it's also, it's so minute, it's one translation, so minute or fine that it fits into spaciousness. It's beyond physical dimensions. And so I think when we say big mind, it's a metaphor. And the feeling of it is very expansive. But actually it's not really big at all. Or small. It has no location, size, observer, no. If it had some size, then it could be observed by something else bigger than it, maybe. There's nothing outside it. By its very definition, there's nothing outside it that could observe it. It's completely all-inclusive. And I agree that this is unlike any other realm of experience, which is the realm of experience. There's always this duality of an observer and observed. This is like, includes all of that. Does that make sense? And you could say, well, how then can we know that it is so? And it knows it is so. And when we kind of just settle into it, there's a kind of, in a way, you could say confirmation. You could say it's confirming itself. It's verifying. Big mind, formless awareness is verifying itself every moment and confirming itself and knowing itself. And like, I am, it's saying to itself. And there's no doubt about it. Just like I would say, none of us have any doubt about it, really. We just don't usually think about it like this. And when we start thinking about it, we can start doubting. But I forget if I brought up last time this 100% sure thing. Like, we talked about it a little bit, like, if you ask someone on the street, right, are you aware right now? Speaking of, nothing special, but just, are you aware? In order to answer the question, they'd have to say yes. If they were having the experience of hearing those words, you could say, well, then there must be awareness present. And so I think it is the thing that we're always 100% sure of. And it's very ordinary.
I would just say that I'm not sure.
Well, our conceptual mind can have all kinds of doubts about this. Yeah.
I just have to put a word in for those who are not sure.
Rachel thinks she's dreaming. She's 96% sure.
Well, we have to say what we, you're not sure if you're aware right now? Is that what you're saying? Are you aware? Right now? Well, if you weren't aware, how could we be having this conversation?
Crazy things happen all the time.
How about another way of, instead of awareness can start having this really special feeling about awareness, what about like, are you experiencing right now? Are you experiencing this conversation? Or not even, maybe to even take you out of it. Is there experiencing of this conversation?
I would say, I think so.
I would say the way I'm using the word experiencing is again, nothing special. It's just that, it's just what we mean by when something's happening. That we know it's being experienced. We can say, it might not, even if it's a computer-generated virtual reality that we're in or something, still, you could say, there's an experiencing of that. There is an experience, even if it's a computer-generated experiencing. This is what I mean by experiencing is just what we call this.
Yeah, I consider dream experiences experiences.
Totally, totally.
And yet they're different.
But they're the same in that they're being experienced, wouldn't you say?
I was swimming, like, under some chairs underwater. sense, but yeah. Also in the sense it wasn't.
Well, I mean, what I mean here by experiencing is that which is exactly the same in that dream and right now. So that is, it's like the most, it's the bottom line, most basic thing. And it doesn't matter whether we're like half asleep, completely asleep and dreaming, totally drunk, totally like confused, totally angry. It's like the experiencing is identical, this the one I'm talking about. And it's not something hidden either. It's just that there is an experiencing of every experience. And the more we get in touch with the experiencing, we see that actually it is the same. Or it never seems to be changing, no matter what the content of the experience is.
Yeah, maybe I'm like a goldfish that is having this swimming experience, but if you asked it, it just wouldn't know what to say.
Yeah, or like Chuang Tzu has this thing of like, I'm not, you know, he wakes up from dreaming he was a butterfly, and then he writes, now I'm not sure if I'm a person dreaming, having dreamt of a butterfly, or a butterfly having a dream of being a person. And I think, and that's a nice contemplation that to be not so sure of that. But but you could ask Chuang Tzu, well, in either case, whether you're the person or the butterfly, is there just experiencing, right? You know, of either human or butterfly, dream and waking? And you'd say yes. And is it the same experiencing as the butterfly and the person? Yes. That's the one, I mean. It doesn't matter whether we're a butterfly.
Or the Chuang Tzu, I know.
The Chuang Tzu that we are right now. Yes.
I was practicing with the experiencing this week. I found it very nice because sometimes at work, you know, I'm talking to people and sometimes they're a little difficult. And I would come to think that experiencing is the commonality. We're all having a different experience, but
that's right.
We are all commonly,
yes.
You know, it's
yep.
Experiencing.
Yeah, yeah.
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 It was kind of nice to
yeah.
think about that.
Yeah. And that's why you know, I haven't ever heard this in the Dharma texts as a synonym or description of Buddha nature, but I'm willing to say this is my current understanding of Buddha nature. Another synonym of it is experiencing, and it fits with all these descriptions very nicely of Buddha nature, because you could say it's what we all share. It's the same for all of us. It's in fact when we're attending to that, we feel this intimacy because we both have our different problems, but we're sharing the same experiencing. We're not sharing the same experience.
Not the same at all.
Yeah. But the experiencing, and the experiencing doesn't come and go. It never seems to change as the experiences change, whether we're dreaming or awake or in whatever kind of state of consciousness. The experiencing is just experiencing. That's all that it does. It doesn't do anything else. And we almost never pay attention to it because it's not a thing to pay attention to. And yet it's always here. It is, and it even makes sense to say it is who we really are. In a way, I couldn't use, like if we're looking for our identity as that which is most stable and true, as ourself, you could say, body and mind is actually maybe not such a good candidate for our true identity because it's changing all the time. There's nothing there stably me, but the experiencing does seem a little bit more like that. And, you know, as this starts to sound like a true self or an Atman or something, in Buddhist language, they like to be sure to say, we also, another name for this experiencing is emptiness. Meaning like, it's empty of any graspable characteristics, it's empty of anything separate from itself, it's empty of duality, and so it's not some reified, special, spiritual entity. It's just emptiness. but it's a kind of knowing emptiness in this version. It's a formless awareness.
The very next line is exactly that.
Let's continue.
Yeah.
Please, Patrick, you're the one to keep us, making sure we keep moving along.
Another question.
35. Liz, would you like to read a paragraph?
We begin to see that thought gives substance to all things, but does not impart essence to anything. The essence of all things is formless awareness, and nothing exists except that the formless makes it so. Read more.
Maybe just to point out there that now we're talking about, that's a pretty big statement, that the essence, we're not even saying of all beings, but of all things, not just of all sentient minds, but the essence of all things is formless awareness. Nothing exists except that formless awareness makes it so. And I think we talked about this a little bit, like this idea of when you're hearing a sound, and you really settle into most direct present experience and really examine that, I would propose we can't find a sound, something called a sound other than the hearing of it or the awareness of the sound. So in that way, what we're calling the sound, or the thing that we call a sound, is actually formless awareness. Or like this piece of paper, right, is a thing, but can we find a piece of paper other than the knowing of it or the experiencing of it? I would say, no, we can't really find that. All we have is the experiencing of it. So therefore, the essence of all things is, or the essence of the true nature of all things is this formless awareness. No thing exists except that formless awareness makes it so. So from that perspective, it's maybe not that big a stretch. We're talking about, from this new perspective, this is how we can talk. So, sure, you can keep going.
As formless awareness comes to the forefront, the sense of being formed diminishes proportionately and peace deepens. Now the words of the Buddha carry a message of unmistakable truth when he says, "The sage who is at peace is not born, does not age, does not die, does not tremble, and does not yearn. For him there does not exist that on account of which he might be born. Not being born, how can he age? Not aging, how can he die? This then is the end of birth and death. The principles of perception formed through abstract thought shape the worldview that we consider normal. Once we are within that worldview, its inherent logic prevents any escape. How could anyone dispute time, distance, separation, birth, and death when that is what we see and experience every day? There is no way out of this psychic container except by questioning the assumptions that hold the view in place. When we question time, distance, and separation, the view becomes transparent and we see what is actually true, not what is conventionally believed. The more fundamental question may be about how many of us are willing to question consensus reality, or have we become like institutionalized inmates and sabotage the power of their release?
It's a strong statement. That's kind of a strong admonition, right? Wow. But I have a sense of that, you know, I feel myself often like an institutionalized inmate sabotaging the time of my release. When I get so invested in the forms of the of apparent world and you know, really suffer over them. And like, even when knowing more and more deeply this formless awareness, trusting it more and more deeply, still, why do I keep sabotaging myself? And I think it's just habits run deep. So it's not like we just hear this once and it's all done, right? We know that this is long practice to, I would say, in a way, to keep clarifying these points, which the Dharma is really good for clarifying through discussions like this. They're so beautiful, I think, because they get a little bit closer in these hints and, you know, through this question and discussion, a little bit, we get a slightly new shift, maybe. That's the hope. That's when, I love it when that happens. We're like, I have some big questions, and somebody will turn it just a little bit, and like, oh, I still have some questions and doubts, but actually, something just went a little notch deeper, a little bit clearer. So we keep clarifying, and then as we clarify more and more, we have to also keep remembering. That's, I think, the hard part. Keep actually practicing the shift of perspective. Keep dropping back into the space.
Or bringing that space into, because you can't stay in that space. I mean, you have to navigate time and distance.
Yeah, it seems like, at least for now, we have to kind of forget about it sometimes when we're driving or something.
If we can bring that formless awareness into the actions that we have to execute constantly,
You could say it that way. I just think as we're clarifying it more and more, I might just shift the language a little bit to more like bring ourselves into it. Because we don't want to think of it as some thing or some method that we can package and bring and use, because it is holding us. Mm. So it's, but I do think it's true that almost like the integration of the form and the formless, we may bring our formed conventional experience more into accord with it. Maybe like that. Yes, that's another line from the Jewel Mirror Samadhi that very nicely demonstrates, I think, is about this point. Yeah, we sometimes, it's a subtle thing, because sometimes we can say, I am it, I am this formless, I am the Jewel Mirror. And that's, in a way, that's true, but it's even more accurate. It makes a little shift to say, actually, it's not so much that I am it, but it is me. It is manifesting. Me meaning the small me, the body and mind, it's expressing, the dual mirror is reflecting a body and mind called Kokyo. Yes?
It seems like there's the discussing it and conceptually kind of trying to get a sense of it, and then, you know, you think of someone like Eckhart Tolle who didn't have any of this practice, and just boom.
Occasionally. Yeah.
For me, though, it's like the retreats where I'm sitting for a whole week.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've done 12 of them, but two of them are where these it was a big shift, not the little ones that go along, but a big shift. And yet it's harder to even kind of go to that space fully again. After that, but
part of why it's hard, I think, is because then we package it, we conceptually package the joy of it and make it in, even slightly make it into something and put it, and then put that thing outside ourselves, outside of the now, and think, how can I recreate that? And, the very paradigm we naturally do that, but that, I think, very thing is what actually obscures it, rather than like, we're talking about this. Always now.
There's such a training for me not to do that, even the not remembering, because it was so long ago, like
mm-hmm.
2011.
Which makes it even more into a distant past thing.
Yeah. The memory in the body
almost. Yeah. And yet, then in a way, then it is there, and then sometimes you may be open to it again in a way that you really notice the shift. And then often at those times, then you remember more clearly the time before and be like, this is exactly like that, and how obvious it is right now. But I can't believe how easy I forget it, and then we forget it again.
One little hour discussion for me. It needs a whole No, I think to sink in and to really feel.
Silence helps, and yet maybe also doesn't have to be. The sense of the shift doesn't necessarily have to be like really dramatic. We like it when it's dramatic, right? because it's a big release and relief. But it can be so ordinary. Like really just we're talking and we just remember that there's this awareness of this body and mind talking right now. It's just a slight shift and nothing, it's definitely not dramatic, but that little shift is, yeah, very, very similar. And maybe as time goes on, the shifts become less dramatic, too. It's more like we're integrating the form and the formless more and more fluidly. Yeah. So this was a beautiful quote from the Buddha that I think when you hear these things outside of discussions like this, the sage does not born, doesn't age or die. We're like, whoa, this is some kind of mystical weirdness. But I think from this perspective, now you can understand that, no, I agree, this is what the Buddha is talking about. It's like the true nature of the sage does not born and does not die. And the Buddha, that was, you maybe know this story, that the Buddha, that's what drove the Buddha to leave home and begin his practice, was he saw old age, sickness, and death, right? And he said, I can't stand this. It was like this existential angst, right? It was like, I can't stand the fact that I'm going to grow old and die. Partly because he was so pampered a life. And suddenly, that was like his realization. It was like, really? This is all going to come to an end? I can't. That's so disturbing to me. And so I got to like deal with this. And I got to find like a long retreat, right? and then so it was like, I don't want to die. And then I think partly because of his initial question is when he realized nirvana, one of the names the Buddha called it was the deathless. So he's like, I set out to find the deathless and I found it. I realize now I'm not actually concerned about this death event. So I think it's one of the deepest ways you can talk about this is no birth and no death. But Buddha called his realization the deathless. And in Zen, sometimes it's called the unborn. It's when Japanese Zen teacher Bankei, whose whole teaching was about the unborn. And he talked about it very ordinary. He talked about it like, when you hear the sound of the crow, the fact that you're hearing the sound of the crow right now is the unborn. It's your unborn Buddha mind. So very much the same teaching. So we finished that chapter. Yeah.
Which reminded me of how it's possible to feel so close to somebody as they're dying, just kind of beyond words, that I was thinking of being by my mother when she was dying.
It may be because...
I think because she heard what she was going through was truly letting go and really experiencing from this... it's a projection, but it seemed like she was experiencing from this place of having let go of the self. Then as a witness, just physically close by, could feel that.
Yes, I think that's true.
Not so worried about where did she go.
Yeah,
Just being able to be in that mystery of it.
Yeah, that's beautiful, yeah. It's from this perspective, we could say, it's this one formless awareness that we all share because we can't find any divisions between my formless awareness and your formless awareness. If we found a division or edge, we'd have to say that's an object or experience of the awareness. So therefore, it's impossible to find a division, so we shouldn't assume there is one. And then if we share this formless awareness, then when you're with somebody dying, it's basically like really the formless awareness is releasing that form of that body, and you could say our body's in such a close vicinity. You could say almost like we can more easily recognize our own formless awareness when we're with someone who's dying. Maybe like this, yeah. Because the form is separating from the formless at that particular crucial moment of death, what we call death of the body. Yeah.
Moment of now that isn't a moment of time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And where did they go? They didn't go anywhere. They're here now. Yeah. Chapter 3. Okay. Next time. Chapter 3, the divided mind. You can bring back the handout too. So maybe have to have saving paper. Yes. And maybe we can get like several class series out of this book. You know, it keeps going in the same direction, but I think he's got some wonderful phrasing of it, and I think he's really some of the like non-duality teachers just really emphasizing the formless awareness and that paradigm. I think the nice thing about, maybe because he's a Theravada Buddhist teacher, he's really emphasizing all the ways we get caught in the divided mind and the conventional mind, and really how that works and how they work together. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to be coming.